Appropriately, this will be a this is a poorly structured presentation. It's also longer than usual, and the reason is that I decided. The reason this topic came up in the first place is that Chapter 8 is, in fact, about messiness. And so I've been thinking about it and said, well, this would be a good thing then to talk about. However, I've probably made the mistake of going back through Chapter 8 and structuring a talk around how that chapter is structured. So we'll see how this works. Okay, there are three... Because there are three subtopics that I want to talk about. Well, three and a half, if you count the first bit. So the first bit is about three types of messiness. The first full bit will be very brief, and it's about why org charts, organizational charts, are so neat. Neat not in the cool and hip way, but just, you know, neat. Second part is about Eleanor Roche, the cognitive psychologist, who gives an empirical underpinning for thinking that things are messier than we've thought they were while we've been under the sway of Aristotle. And part three asks about attempts to clean up the internet, in particular the semantic web, and whether the Roche stuff, which is prototype theory, whether that applies to the web at all. So, here goes. So the first part, this is book referential. I hope you don't mind. So the book talks about, much earlier on, about there being three types of order. The first type of order being when you organize the things themselves, the books on the shelf. The second order of order is when you separate the metadata physically and you organize, say, the catalog cards. And a third type is in the digital age, when both the content and the metadata are online. They're all digital. And the old limitations of ordering, which are the limitations of what you can do with physical things, whether it's the physical objects or the physical metadata about the objects, what you do with order when you don't have those limitations. I believe that wasn't actually a sentence, but...
It was close enough for
podcasting.
Podcasting is fine.
Close enough for podcasting. Excellent.
Is that Catherine in the middle picture?
Just a little bit.
There are three orders of messes that correspond to this three orders of order. And the first type, an example, is what is frequently... This is Filene's basement. Once every year during spring, they lower... prices on gowns, wedding gowns, from thousands of dollars to $269, $499, and $699. Some price like that. People line. Second is this is a poor illustration of it, but it's a mess. What you would get if you took all of the card catalog cards out of a card catalog, dumped them on the floor, all the metadata would be in a big pile, and it would be useless. It would be absolutely useless to you. In the third type of mess, in the third order of order, you have big piles of lots and lots of stuff. You try to include as much as possible, and you find as many relationships among the pieces as you can, or you actually allow users to find as many relationships as they can, and you leave it to the users to sort through this in ways that they find useful. And users develop incredible tools and find patterns, and from playlists to hierarchical trees to tags to whatever it is we're going to invent. So the third order is just a mess, but that's the good thing about it, because as a mess, you don't have to, as a digital mess, you don't have to clean it up in order to order it. So if you're Felix and Oscar from The Odd Couple, and Felix likes to arrange the silverware carefully, not only by fork and spoon, but by height or by how clean they are, or whatever it is that Felix is the clean one, I believe, whatever it is that Felix likes to do. And Oscar comes in, and he hates that way of organizing it, so every time Felix cleans it up, he dumps it all out into a drawer together because it's easier for him or whatever, and the audience laughs, and you have a nice little sitcom. In real-world messages, you have to, if somebody cleans it up, the other person has to rearrange the stuff and destroy that order in order to create a new order. You can only arrange the silverware one way. Mm-hmm. In a third order mess, you don't have to do anything. If I create a playlist or create a web page that lists my favorite podcasts, with, of course, ThoughtCast at the top of the list, and I'm picking podcasts from all over the web, I don't have to actually move anything on the web to do that. And if somebody has a different playlist of their top 10, they don't have to organize it any differently. I mean, it's a big mess. You don't have to change the mess in order to clean it up. And that's one of its greatest strengths. So, first in the chapter, I look at more or less, I guess, the history of organizational charts. The question being, why are they neat? And the answer is pretty simple. They were neat because that's how they were designed. I mean, the whole point of them is to neaten up what looked like a messy organization. So, of course, they're neat. This is Daniel McCollum, who is credited with doing the first org chart for the Erie Railroad. Shortly before the Civil War, this is him in his Civil War uniform. He was not the first to create a hierarchical organization out of a business, but he was the first to actually draw the chart. And with the chart came some rules, five principles. And it turns out that one of the reasons for doing a chart like this, from the very beginning, it was not just about authority, it was about the transfer, movement, and communication of information. I mean, they wanted to be able to know exactly where all their trains were at any one time. They got enormous savings and efficiencies if they could do that. It was the confusion of a merger that got McCollum to do this org chart. It was all about information. And one of his five principles, in fact, says that we need reports. We need daily, monthly reports, hourly, daily, monthly reports, because we need this information. And it's, however, also important that reports only go up to the next level in the chart. This chart did not flow in two directions, even though it was a chart of information as well as of power. And the reason was explicitly to protect managers so they would not have to pass up information that was either wrong or possibly embarrassing. It was to protect protect the authority and power of the managers. So from the beginning, org charts were neat because that was their whole aim. It's no surprise at all. Dotted lines we don't like in charts because they mess them up. There was a dotted line when there was a Soviet Union, back when the Atomic Energy Agency was created in the UN, as part of, thanks to Eisenhower's speech about atoms for peace, this agency was set up. The Soviets only agreed to it after it was decided that it would have a dotted line authority into the Security Council, because USSR had a veto power over in the Security Council, and they wanted that protection. So a dotted line was added. But that's what it takes to get a dotted line. You have to be a nuclear power, basically. You know, it's a serious arm twisting. We don't like dotted lines. They're exceptions. You get too many of them, and everything's messed up. We like the simplicity. One of the reasons I think we like the simplicity, by the way, and why org charts work the way they do, and you can see this especially in the org chart that is the tree of life, is that they're printed on paper. We have to be able to express our relationships in two dimensions, because that's how publishing works. And dotted lines are essentially a third-dimensional item. I mean, they sort of hop over the lines that are there, and that's just a little hard to show in two dimensions, especially if you have too many of them. One of the reasons why the tree of life looks like the tree of life, instead of the bush of life, which it in fact is, as Stephen Jay Gould so frequently pointed out, said, trees work real well in two dimensions. Bushes don't. Bushes, you really want a three-dimensional thing to talk about. There are lots of them coming out of that central central route. So we're used to very clean org charts that are more white space than anything else. And then, oh, about 10 years ago, with increasing velocity now, there is a hankering for more complex org charts. Very big businesses are bringing in people like Valdis Krebs, and this is his work at orgnet.com, to map social networks, precisely because people want to see the mess. They understand that the org chart is not capturing enough. In some sense, it's too neat. And so if this map of, this is a map of email relationships, and there's no key just because I didn't put it in, but Valdis can tell you what this means. It's a fairly typical sort of network map with some hubs, not an even sort of topology at all, but ones with hubs or centers or hills. If this map were too simple and orderly, the company would be disappointed. The company that paid for it would feel that Valdis hadn't done his job, or that he had and the company hadn't learned enough. And the value of this is precisely in its messiness. And Valdis can go in and say, so here's your org chart. It's nice and neat. Now take a look at this. And he slaps this down. And the more crosses and nodes all mushed together, the more likely people are likely to go, wow, man, oh, we got to look into this. Or we're really learning something from this. Complexity... complication, anyway, now is increasingly being seen as a value because it's revealing relationships that are actually there, and those relationships frequently have very little to do with the neat and clean ones. And there's just tons and tons of stories about this. One that Valdis tells is about he says who it is. It's TRW, where he was working, where they had hired a hotshot pilot, famous in the industry, and they did this one of these charts of influence, who talks with whom. And this pilot had nobody talking to him. But this woman who Valdis says, let's call Mary, who was not well known, not in a position of influence, she was a hub. I mean, everybody was talking to Mary. And Valdis did a little work. In fact, I think the story actually is that when he presented this, people were very quiet. At first they thought that the data was off, and Valdis assured them that it was not. Then finally somebody said, yeah, well, the pilot's a jerk. Whereas Mary not only was friendly, but she knew everybody there, and you'd go in and she knew what the politics were and how projects worked, and so she would actually help you get to the next step, whereas the pilot just didn't care. These sorts of charts reveal the value that's in the organization, doesn't always reflect the org chart, and reveals the complexity that is actually driving the company forward. So I actually asked Valdis how many different maps could you make? And he said, basically, how many questions do you have? And we can do a different one for everything from who do you send email to who are sources of rumors. I mean, there's no end to the number of slices you can take through this, and it's always messy. Okay, so that's the messy org chart, and maybe that's only true of social relationships, but of course it's not. So I want to talk about Eleanor Roche, who gives an empirical underpinning for thinking that the world is much messier, and our understanding of the world at its most basic level is far messier than we thought. And in fact, that attempts to clean it up too much often hide more than they reveal. So I've talked about her before, but I think she's really important. This is work she did in the 70s. So cognitive psychologists they know about this, and they've already decided that she's right or that she's full of crap. And since she challenges the basic notions of the discipline, there are lots who think that she's full of crap. I don't, but I'm not a specialist. What she says makes huge sense to me. The background for this is the Aristotelian view that is behind not just cognitive psychology, but also much of how we think about how the world is organized. That Aristotelian view says that, we have categories. Everybody agrees about that. A word is a category. A word is a way of taking a set of things that aren't exactly alike and saying, well, but they do have some essential similarity. So no two dogs are alike. There are lots of breeds of dogs, and even two dogs from the same litter obviously are not exactly alike. But in order for us to proceed as a species to understand anything, we need, well, that's not an Aristotelian way of putting it, so I take that back. In order for us to understand the order behind the apparent chaos of the world, we need to be able to see the categories that say, oh, that's a dog, even though it's clearly different from that dog and that other dog. We only need categories because things are different. So what makes something, what defines a category? That very way of asking it puts it within Aristotle's territory, because for Aristotle, what makes something, what defines a category is in fact a definition. It is the task of knowledge, of knowing, to seek out those definitions, and to see what is essential about the creatures in a category. Right? Creatures and things that we create, of course. So for Aristotle, there is an essence, and that makes a dog and a chair, and that essence can be expressed in a definition. One of the consequences of that is that anything that meets the definition is a member of that category. One of the consequences of that is that, therefore, all members of a category are equally good examples of a category, because they've all met the criteria. So Roche comes along, and I'll skip the sort of story of how she got here, but discovers that, in fact, that's not how we think. That's not how we organize our world. There are huge problems with Aristotelian essentialism to begin with. It's very murky. Why? What it means to say that something has an essence. It's very murky trying to figure out exactly what that essence is. It means you have to distinguish between essence and accidents. So what makes a dog is not the fact that it has a cold nose, although dogs do have cold noses. That's, you can imagine a dog that didn't have a cold nose, but you, I don't know what the essence of a dog is, so it's a bad example, but the essence of a bachelor is that he's an unmarried male human, not that the bachelor has ears. So we spent 2,500 years trying to work through what makes a characteristic the essence and what makes it an accident, and it's really, really hard to do, because there's actually something wrong with the entire procedure. So, Roche comes along and says, you know what? We don't actually have these essences. We don't refer to them in our thinking. There's no reason to think that we're referring back to definitions as we categorize the world, as we look out at the world, as we perceive it, as we talk about it. And furthermore, she shows that we don't really think that all members of a category are equally good members of a category. Some are great and some are lousy, and the great ones she calls prototypes. And the others are members of the category because they're sort of like the prototype, sort of kind of like. And some of them are very much like, and some of them are sort of kind of like. And we talk about them just like that. And we recognize those distinctions, and we can show that empirically, which is what she then spent the next decade doing, devising some very clever tests, experiments that showed, yeah, we do distinguish between good examples and bad examples, which is a completely commonsensical thing, but she's arguing against a science that is based upon Aristotelian principles, so she needs the empirical evidence. So this is what she does. So first of all, there is a line in philosophy, started by Wittgenstein, that she refers back to. It turns out that she did her undergraduate paper on Wittgenstein. That stood her in good stead as she started doing this work. So Wittgenstein has the notion of a family resemblance. Is this completely familiar? Is this familiar to everybody here? It is one of the more... So I'm going to go ahead then. Okay. Wittgenstein, who's just this... I won't even try for an adjective. He's a really brilliant philosopher and very playful, inventive mind. Philosophers have been Aristotelians too. They have thought that, and we have inherited this from them, that... to know something is to find its definition. And if you can't define it, you don't really know what it is. That knowledge and definitions go together. So Wittgenstein comes along and says, well, yeah, what about games? Will you please define a game for me? And before you do, keep in mind that here are things that we agree are games. Football, Scrabble, solitaire. A kid throwing a stick up into the air and catching it repeatedly. You know, he's playing a game. hopscotch and I don't know. What's that game with the stones and the brooms?
Oh, curling.
Curling. Thank you very much. Plus, there's and Monopoly, chess. So now, come up with a definition that covers all of those. Because if you don't, if the definition leaves out some, then clearly the definition is wrong. That's how the definition game works ever since Socrates. So go ahead, come on, bring it on. And of course, nobody can. In fact, Wittgenstein says a word like games, a concept, a category like games, is more like a family resemblance. That's what defines it, not a definition. So in a family resemblance, there is no single characteristic running through all of the people who have that resemblance. So let's say Uncle Carl is really the best example of a family resemblance, and he's got the big ears and the snub nose and the triple chins and the arched eyebrows. Well, cousin Carlita, she's got the triple chins, but she doesn't have the ears and has the other one. So there may be no one characteristic for the entire family. Nevertheless, there's a strong family resemblance. It's a real thing. And the same thing is true for a concept like a category, like games, that there's no one thing, no one criterion you can find across all the things we call games. And games is not an exception. In fact, as you look at more and more of these abstract noun categories, and it turns out not just nouns, by the way, vehicles. Man, vehicles, it's really hard to figure out. A car, absolutely good vehicle. Truck, good vehicle. Skateboard, sort of a vehicle. You can count that. I'm going to count that as a vehicle. Maybe you don't. We can argue about it. Surfboard, maybe. Roller skates, not. Roller skates, I don't think, are vehicles.
It's a game.
It's edges on game, but it's not quite. Gliders are vehicles. Hang gliders, I guess, are vehicles. Family resemblance, and no single definition. And even if you did manage, by the way, to come up with a perfect definition that captures all of the vehicles, we'd still have the fact that not everything is an equally good example of a vehicle, and there's no reason to think we are consulting that definition every time we see a vehicle or decide what a vehicle is. Because the fact is, if you come up with that definition, you'll be the first one. I haven't heard it. And so clearly, at least at some level, I don't know what that definition is, so how can I be using that as the way for me to decide what I call a vehicle or not? Rosh's prototype approach makes much more sense. So she goes through a number of experiments, looking particularly at this notion of basic level objects. So basic level object, this is more than you need to know, but I don't care. So a basic level object is something like a chair, as opposed to furniture, or as opposed to a rocking chair. The basic level, it gets a little tricky, especially the difference between a chair and a rocking chair, but the basic level object is the thing that if I asked you, what are you sitting in, you will not say furniture. You will say chair. Now, it's possible, depending on the context, you may say, I'm sitting in a rolling desk chair. But that's context dependent. More frequently, normally, you're going to say chair. And the lower level of precision is separable from the basic level object. So these are not Platonic ideals, that there's a set of basic level objects that exist across all cultures, because they don't, that are the same for all cultures, because they're not.
Why is a chair not a Platonic
idea? Because it's different across cultures. And because if you're in a chair store and you're trying to pick a chair, and somebody the salesperson comes up and says, "How can I help you? What can I show you today?" And if you say chairs, you're making a stupid joke or you're being obnoxious. What you really have to say is, "I'm looking for an easy chair." So in that, it's circumstance context dependent. Also, because there's no need to postulate a realm of eternal existing stuff. So we know that it's different across cultures. A whole bunch of people have done work on this. It's not just Rosh working on this. There have been studies across 98 languages what do people mean by some set of concepts. So, for example, it turns out that the Germans, if you ask a German for an example of furniture, the higher level that they will give you different examples than if you ask an American for examples of furniture. Now, we'll say chairs and tables, and I think the Germans, sorry, I'm very bad at facts, but I think the Germans say beds and tables. And beds and tables?
Well, there's something called a Bank, which kind of incorporates both, and it's very strange.
Both what?
Both, it's kind of a, it can be used as a bed, it's also used as a table, it can kind of be used as a chair as well. It's just very, very weird.
Yes, we call them orange crates, or cable spools. But, yeah.
But for them, they're a big deal. Yeah, so, I mean, if I ask for an example of furniture, I'm not going to say, oh, an orange crate.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. No. So you, one can actually ask, given that we give different examples, and the category, the Möbel, pardon my German, the French, German word for furniture, has different basic level objects and may cover, they may count things that we don't. That, I mean, that's a non-solvable translation problem, which at least now can be expressed. So she does a number of experiments, discovers that if you ask subjects to list attributes, everything they can think of that's a property of a set of things, and some of them are upper level, some of them are higher and more abstract, and some of them are basic level. The basic level ones, they will list more attributes, that these are richer in things to talk about, which makes some evolutionary sense, since the guess is that the evolutionary advantage to having categories is that it lets us humans look out across a very varied field and learn one way of reacting to things, not have to learn a new way for every rock or animal that we see, because we're able to categorize. In fact, one of the things that she discovered was that for basic level objects, if you ask people to list motor movements that are associated with those objects, they're able to list more than if you ask them to list motor movements associated with the higher level categories. So if you ask somebody, what do you do physically with a chair, they'll sort of mime sitting down, maybe getting their arms adjusted. If you ask them, what do you do with furniture, they don't really know what to do, because it's, you know. So there is some objectivity to the basic level objects. Also, the important point about the motor movements is that, I think, is about 20 years later, Rosh writes a book about embodied cognition, about the role of the body in cognition. So cognitive psychologists and AI people have tended to think of thought as something that is mental, that's simply knowing, whereas this finding about motor movements is a hint that concepts are actually in part not just how we visualize them or what the definition is of the thing, but is also how our bodies are getting ready to use them. That one of the reasons we have categories evolutionarily is precisely so we'll know how to operate in the world with our bodies, which is somewhat important. Other researchers showed that that children learn the basic level concepts sooner than they learn the higher level ones. They learn the higher level ones between 3 and 4. There's a huge gap, advance in how well they recognize higher level concepts, things like furniture, between 3 and 4. And one other finding, this is just along the line of the empirical, there's also been anthropological studies supporting the notion of prototypes. If you take a set of basic level objects in a category, like a whole set of different chairs, or cars within the larger category of vehicles. If you take the basic level objects like chairs or cars and you overlap them all, you just get an averaged outline of them. The variance is much less than if you overlap elements of upper level category. So I'll do vehicles. You take all the things that are clearly vehicles, that are basic level objects within vehicles, like cars, and you average the shape of cars, you'll get, in fact, a recognizable car. People will recognize that as a car, that average shape. If you take all the vehicles, which includes boats, planes, cars, the average is just unrecognizable. So she develops empirical evidence that, one other important test, which was showing people pictures of elements of objects within a basic level category. Like, for example, showing them pictures of birds. and you ask them to press the buzzer. If it is, in fact, a picture of a bird that you're showing them, they will press the buzzer very quickly for robins and sparrows, but there's a little bit of a lag for penguins and ostriches, because those are not good examples of birds. They're absolutely birds, they're just not good examples of them. And so there's empirical evidence that, in fact, we do think this way. There's evolutionary reasons to think that we do think this way as well, but this has implications. For one thing, most important for my purposes, means that categories don't have neat edges. That we are very happy, this is a quote from Joshua Schachter, actually, is that something can be 78% in a category. He might have said 73%. I have it in my notes somewhere. That's exactly right. It's not right for Aristotle, but it is right for the way we think about things, and we express that as, sort of like. George Lakoff, whose book Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things, is essentially a explanation of Roche's theories and their philosophical importance, and is well nigh unreadable. Nevertheless, it's really, really hard. I couldn't get through it. Is it in that book? I don't remember. A list of hedge words. I think it's not that. I think it's the metaphors we live by which we indicate that something is not a full member of a category. We say it's sort of kind of like it. It's partially like, there's a long list of ways that we have of hedging category statements, and very precise, actually, very very careful about it. So we are totally at home with the notion that things are only somewhat like other things, that things are partially in categories or kind of in categories, a notion that the Aristotelians take as a problem for thought. That we need, that this is an error we're making, and it's up to knowledge and the purveyors of knowledge to clean this up for us. Well, if Roche is right, certainly there are places where you want to have very precise definitions. I mean, that's absolutely clear. The motor vehicles department has to decide whether they need to issue a license for a kid's push scooter. Is that a vehicle? So there are absolutely places you want to draw lines, but that has very little to do with how we actually operate and think about and live in our world. So, now to part three, which is on the web. What does this mean? And I'm not entirely sure. So, it is not the case that prototype theory maps onto the web really nicely. It doesn't. There are not a lot of places where we actually use prototypes on the web. There are a couple. There is face recognition software that's becoming commercially available that allows you to pick out a photo of Aunt Julia and say, see that face, software, see that face? That's Aunt Julia. That's your prototype. Now find me every other picture that has a face that's sort of kind of like that, and it reports back and says, I am 95% confident that that's Aunt Julia, and 40% confident. So that actually is a sort of prototype work. It's not tremendously important, though. The other not very important, but I think actually pretty good example of prototypes on the web is search engines like Google, but not only Google, that allow you to point at a page and say, find me more like this. And it may be, in a sense, you're taking that original page as a prototype and you're asking. So, yeah, it shows up in some places, but I think that's not likely to be the real effect of prototype theory.
Could a keyword serve as a prototype in search?
It's not a good example of a prototype, if you know what I mean.
It's not very helpful in search either, because it's too broad.
You're not trying to find. If it were a prototype, you'd be saying, find me other words that are sort of kind of like that. And you're not quite doing that. You're saying, find me documents that contain this word, or you can do more sophisticated things, documents that are about this word. But that does actually get at what I want to get to at the end, so please don't anticipate what I'm about to say. That's one of the values of the prototype theory, sort of one of the properties of it, but not prototype theory itself. In fact, I think this is sort of like what has happened with Ranganathan, I don't know how to pronounce his name, who was a 1930s Indian librarian, and the father of library science, who created the worst named classification system or anything ever called colon classification system, which very few libraries use, even though it's a powerful way of... I did it in the face of Dewey. He did it in part, to a large degree, because Dewey was gaining ground in India and he wanted to have something homegrown and something that avoided some of the difficulties of Dewey. So he came up with this way of classifying. It's very intricate. Very few libraries use it. However, the principles of colon classification became the principles of faceted classification, which is becoming very popular on the web. Although it's not always recognized as such. I don't want to, because this is simply an analogy to what I think is happening with prototype, I don't want to go through everything about faceted classification, but it's a very powerful way of sorting through complex, well-structured data. So Ranganathan has an influence, not directly because his system is moving on, but the principles of his system, the properties of his system, get taken up in a different way, and I think the same thing will happen with prototype theory. And I'll show you how, I think, in a minute. So this is Tim Berners-Lee, who looks out over the web and has some level of disappointment, which is really sort of heartbreaking, you know, because if anybody should be proud of what he's done. And he is. This is, I'm not saying he's a depressed person and we need to chip in to get him Prozac. I'm saying that he thinks that the web has not met all of its potential because it's too messy. There's not enough semantics in it. And so he came up with the notion of the semantic web. The odd thing is, of course, that the... I'm going to take away this hugely distracting slide. Hold on. Is that the web is all semantics. I mean, that's the problem, insofar you see it as a problem. The web is nothing but semantics. It's pages humans have written full of meaning. The real problem, is that the code for the web doesn't have room for semantics. HTML doesn't have semantics. It's all syntax. So all links are alike. Expressed in HTML, they're all href equals, and then the link. Right? That doesn't tell you in the code. So when you write in your web blog... I heard this terrific podcast over at ThoughtCast. Jenny Atiyah is here, so I'm totally sucking up. You ought to go hear it. So-and-so talks brilliantly about that semantics telling, and here's the link, and click on the link. All that text is the semantics telling you the nature and the evaluation, whatever else Jenny wants to tell us. The HTML for that is simply href equals, and we don't know from that code itself whether Jenny likes it, hates it, or what it's about. So it's the code that doesn't have the semantics, and Tim Berners-Lee wants to help take care of that problem because machines are not very good at reading text. They have difficulty telling whether Jenny's being sarcastic or not when she says, this is the greatest thing I ever heard. But machines are really good at reading code, obviously. So it seems to me that this semantic web goes straight back to Tim Berners-Lee's first project at CERN, where he's working when he had the idea for the web. Before he did that, his project was Enquire, which he called as a shout-out to a Victorian sort of encyclopedia, which was called Enquirer Within Upon Everything, supposed to sum up the world's knowledge in a friendly way. So he called it Enquire, and the idea behind Enquire was that if you could model a complex, relatively complex system, like a vacuum pump, which was his example, you take all the parts of that pump, and then you give them each, you make each one into an online object, a computer object, and you also model all the relationships among those. And there's a standard set of relationships that we can devise, that Enquire devises, for explaining the relationships among these parts. There are things like includes, I guess that would be is part of also. X describes Y, Y depends on X. So there's a couple handful of relationships. And so these links in Enquire have meaning. They're not just A points at B, it's A includes B, A depends on B. And so Enquire is smarter than HTML is. Well, so Berners-Lee comes up with HTML after this, and HTML links are very stupid on purpose because if you want to have the web turn into a universal information space, which is exactly what Berners-Lee was thinking at the time, that's what he wrote, you have to make it as easy as possible for people to plug their pieces into this, their web pages into this. And the way that you do that is you make it incredibly easy for somebody to point at another page. And to do that, you make the link stupid. If you tried to make the link smart and say, before you link, you have to decide which of the following 1,800 different relationships you have in mind, then people would not link near, you know, the web would not have taken off. So we end up with a permission-free link to anybody you want. Put all the semantics into the text around the code, but don't put any into the code, and do not have a standardized set of what those relationships are. The attempt to build a standardized set of relationships, that's SGML. That's what HTML was built out of. And SGML failed as a commercial application. SGML wanted to be the language for all documents in the world, but it was too complex for precisely this reason. HTML gets over that by being stupid in the good sense, in the David Eisenberg sense. So now I've called David Eisenberg stupid too. But if you Google Eisenberg, if you don't know already, you'll see why that's a compliment. So we get from inquire to the web by enabling no hoops and thus a stupid network that takes off like nobody's business, like nobody, including Tim Berners-Lee, could have anticipated. But Berners-Lee recognizes that there is a price to be paid for this. The computers are not able to figure out what's going on people's websites. They can't figure out what the information is that's being displayed on people's websites because the syntax is not, it's not being captured. There's no syntax for capturing it. So RDF is invented, Resource Description Framework. RDF is the language of the semantic web. And people, huge debates over what the semantic web is. There is, I believe, uniform agreement that whatever the semantic web is, it's made out of RDF. RDF works by, do you disagree?
Well, the microformats people would disagree with it, but that's not germane
on the topic. Okay, well, we should come back to it.
Well, yeah, we'll come back to it. Yeah, we'll come back.
So the RDF is a very simple format. RDF says we're going to, there's a bunch of relationships in the information that you're making available on your website. And in Berners-Lee's prototypical example, the one in the Scientific American article, is a doctor's office, and somebody's trying to make an appointment for his mother and wants to find a time for an appointment and then wants to also figure out what the bus schedules so the mother can get there, and that all this information for appointments and bus schedules, et cetera, is in, if it's available at all, it's not in ways that computers can read it. So what we need is a way to standardize this. RDF is the syntax for doing that. With RDF, you connect two terms with a relationship. And that's all it is. It's a set of triples. A is in some relationship to B. And you get to specify what those relationships are, because the relationships that work for a doctor's office don't work for a bus schedule, obviously. So in order to specify those relationships, you build ontologies. And so an ontology is a set of figure-outable relationships within a domain. For documents within the library, for example, the relationships might be things like documents have authors. Books have readers. Books have chapters. Readers have library card numbers, etc. So a set of triples that are in relationship, that set of relationships is called an ontology. One approach to this, the one that I think is most known, it's most sort of the prototype of semantic web, although I could be wrong about this, are these large honking ontologies that try to cover everything about some large domain. One example, and I'm probably being unfair, but I don't care, is legal RDF, which is one of several attempts to provide an ontology for everything you might want to express about the law. Well, the law is pretty damn big. So you need to be able to, you can get there through hypergrove.com/legalrdf.org, or just Google legal-rdf. It's got classes of terms for everything, from nouns, products, property, because, law also touches on economics. It has a set of economics terms. Here's a little drill down on this. This is, so on this capture you can see goods, intellectual property, personal property, products, and property. And then I think the next page is just the beginning of the products section. And product section starts with above ground storage tank. This is like all the products that might show up in law. ABS pipe, accent light, accordion door, acoustic tile. There's a certain, let's say, noble insanity to this. This is nuts. You're going to specify everything, and that's just the objects. Now we have all the people, all the economic relationships, all the actions. Thousands and thousands of terms. This is so reminiscent of the 19th and 20th century attempts to build gigantic taxonomies that are comprehensive, that cover everything and put it in the right relationship. Now, ontologies are messier than top-down hierarchical taxonomies. They can be sprawled when you diagram them, they get very messy, which is a good thing. It captures more of that of those multiple relationships. Nevertheless, it seems to me the same type of person who would do one would do the other, and it suffers from some of the same problems. Clay Shirky is notorious for having pointed this out in an article called Ontologies Are Overrated, which is actually, I think, overly harsh, but sure makes the point that there's something just gone awry here. So I say gone awry. If it works, it hasn't gone awry. Maybe this legal RDF is being a very useful tool in some environments, in which case I'm just plain wrong. It doesn't have to be completely comprehensive to be useful. There is something, however, to my mind, suspicious about the belief that we can capture all knowledge, make it all explicit, and write it down in any one domain. It slights the importance of the implicit, which is, in fact, Chapter 7. That's the type of semantic web that's easiest to get exercised about. But there's lots of other approaches, and one of them that I like, that seems to make sense to me, is what Timothy Falconer calls the smushy approach, which is a much more ad hoc approach. And it says, look, I mean, that's fine. Go do that if you want. That's obsessive compulsive behavior. Those big types of ontologies. What we really need, and what the semantic web is really about, a well-structured one, is you build the RDF triples that you need. You build the ontology that you need for your domain and nothing more. And you do it as you need it. You don't try to wait till everything's done. We need some terms. And most important, do not repeat the work that's been done by others. So if you're a medical site and you want to, part of your ontology is you need to be able to refer to medical articles, do not create an ontology for documents, because that's been done. In fact, the Dublin Core is a pretty well-known ontology for documents. They have figured out what a bunch of these relationships are. Use that one. And RDF is well set up to allow you just to point to some other ontology. So you point at the Dublin Core and use that one. And that has the advantage of saving you work, but also, more important, it means that a computer that comes along and is trying to process your data that knows about the Dublin Core now automatically knows about yours. It's a way of stitching together pieces, and you do it sort of bit by bit, little bit by little bit, and it's never perfect. It's never going to be perfect. It's never comprehensive, but it's working well enough. And over time, as more of these little bits get stitched together, because a doctor's office does it, and a carpentry site does it, and the Girl Scouts do it, bit by bit, you get a semantic web that's stitched together out of these pieces. It does not capture everything about human life. One of the reasons why people got exercised, including me, about the semantic web early on is that Berners-Lee talked about this in terms of knowledge representations. Knowledge representations have a bad history, for some of us anyway, that it's artificial intelligence systems have tried to do the knowledge representation thing. That is, they've said, you know what, to be intelligent, we need to give computers an inner picture of the outer world because that's how we work. Well, I don't think that's how we work, first of all, and second of all, the attempt to tell a computer everything it needs to know in order to be able to have common sense is such a huge task. It failed to any reasonable degree. It failed in artificial intelligence. There are two remaining attempts to do it. CYC, which is Doug Lennett's project, and there's an open source version of Psych at MIT called OpenMind.
I was about to tell you about that.
And those are interesting for different reasons, but and neither one, by the way, says that the outcome of these will be knowledge representations will be consciousness, the way some of these strong AI people did. Anyway, so the big knowledge representation, the big ontology thing, I think raises a lot of flags for a lot of people, including me. The smushy approach, which is far messier, seems to me to be far more likely to succeed. Well, there is a question about whether RDF was designed with messiness in mind. Because it's the messiness of the smushy approach that actually gives it a chance of succeeding. Having to pin everything down ahead of time? Nah. The issue is that RDF does not seem to have an easy way to represent prototypical relationships of sort of, kind of, those sort of, kind of relationships. So you can say A relates to B, but it's very hard to say in RDF that A sort of kind of relates to B, or, for example, Bill pretty much likes Mary, or even if you could quantify it, Bill 0.73 likes Mary. There is no art, you can't get both the 0.73 and the likes Mary into a single triple, and it's very hard to figure out how to coordinate. Paris is 80% likely, that word is 87% likely to refer to the one in France, because there's something like 150 Parises in the world, or Niagara Falls are 80% in Canada. So the RDF people will tell you there are ways of solving each of these problems, but some of them are pretty roundabout. RDF was not designed by people who were thinking about sort of kind of relationships. They were thinking about nice, clear, clean molecules of knowledge. And that is maybe a practical limitation on RDF. Maybe it just means you've got to do a lot more coding to capture it. But if you were thinking about Eleanor Roche's view of the world, if you're thinking about prototypes, you would not have come up with this with RDF as it exists. So I'm now going to get pretty vague, but I'm getting towards the end, so that's good. Prototypes don't show up much on the web, except in the two little cases I gave of examples. Find other pages like this and face recognition. Find more pictures like this. But that's not a big deal. But the properties of prototype theory, which are that we understand things through sort of kind of relationships, that things can be partially in a category and partly not, that there are family resemblances among things. Those properties do show up on the web quite a bit. In fact, I would say that they're in fact typical of the web. Here is one example. This is a cluster. I'm sorry, this is not a cluster. This is a page at Flickr if you search for the tag Italy. So all of these photos have been tagged Italy. Well, which means it's not a family resemblance, because a family resemblance has no one thing in common, but these all do have one thing in common, namely they've been tagged Italy. But if you take away that, it actually is a family resemblance. You can't find a single thing, I don't think, in all the pictures of all that have been tagged Italy that they have in common. Some are easy to tell why they're tagged Italy, or at least you can suspect. So there are a couple of landscapes, and I'm quite confident those are landscapes of Italy. Some are food, which are either food in Italy or Italian food. I'm not sure which, but pretty confident it's one of those two. And some are there's somebody standing in front of the Colosseum, so that one I know. And then there's some people, and either they are Italian or they're in Italy, or it could be something else. It could be Italy night at the local church. You don't know, but you have some degree of confidence. So here's, and we take guesses at these, and some of them we're just never, ever, ever going to figure out why. There is one not in this set, but I came across when I was looking, the day I was looking for the book, there's a beautiful professional photography style photograph of a toothbrush with toothpaste on it, tagged Italy. I'm never going to know why that one was tagged Italy. You know, I can make up stories, but that's all you're doing. So here on this page is, there's no prototype here. This is not a prototype theory thing, in that there was one picture of Italy that somebody declared as the prototype, and this clustered all of them around it. Nevertheless, the properties of prototype theory are here. No single explanation, sort of kind of relationships, some good examples, some less good examples, and that this is fine. It's fine for an application like Flickr. It's fine for most blogs. Not always fine. Sometimes we need strict definitions. And so we do that where appropriate. So what does this mean for knowledge? Well, under this view, the classical view of knowledge as figuring out what a definition is that captures and explains all of the elements, all the members of a category by pointing at what's essential to them, in that view of knowledge is an attempt to separate, to simplify, and to freeze into something eternal, what something is. And it says anything less than that is not knowledge. If you haven't done that, then you don't really know what you're talking about. You haven't done, knowledge is a knife. It pares away what you don't need, and what you do find is eternal, or at least long-lasting. That's not how things are working. That's not how knowledge is working, frankly, ever, in fact, especially in our lives, and certainly hardly ever on the web. Now, of course, you do find that on the... We find everything on the web. There is room for that type of knowledge, but it's not the only type of knowledge, and it's not characteristic. It's not our essence, is what I'm trying to say. So if you want to order the chemical elements, you can go Mendeleev, and a single criterion determines, in a very Aristotelian way, single criterion determines what that order is. It's the atomic weight. And you know that that's it. You're done. And that works. That's fine. That's an Aristotelian organization, and it works really well. And we got smarter because of that. We don't want to lose that. But in the messiness of the web, one way of organizing things does not require you to undo. You can have multiple ways. So we got that. Far more prevalent, and I think actually in many ways more important, is the sort of understanding that occurs on the web, which is sort of and kind of. The form of organization that's sort of, kind of, and 73% in a category. That's it.
I finally understand the tag fascination.
And maybe you can explain it to me.
It allows for overlapping, right?
Yeah, that's the big part of it. Yeah. It also allows for somebody other than either the creator or an authority to determine what the category is.
Right. A part of me wonders if we have to maintain the illusion of being able to perfectly define and categorize things in order to get far enough that we create at least messy systems that we can connect to each other. This is not so much a theoretical comment as maybe a social, psychological comment. You know, a lot of helpful classification systems have come out of people who really thought they'd figured it out. And, you know, your approach, which I tend to agree with, says none of those are completely right, but most of them have something helpful to say. So I don't know. There's a piece of me that just gets worried when we get it out there in the open that we can't figure it all out. You know, it feels like we need a few people out there that still have really drunk the Kool-Aid. Otherwise, we're all just going to be lazily tagging, and we're going to be lost. You ever feel that hopelessness?
Well, this is why before we started, I was saying that I was happy because I've written page one of chapter 9. I'm very book focused. The book organizes my life. Okay, so chapter 9 is the last chapter. It's on something like what's up with knowledge, and I've been dreading having. I don't want to. Knowledge doesn't need anybody else tearing it down. Right, we've got entire political. We have an administration that does nothing but. It's the last thing I want to do is to contribute to no-nothingism. So it's important to me to be able to say in Chapter 9 and in life that, in fact, no, what we've been doing with knowledge is really important, and we are, as a species, incredibly good at it. This is a skill that we've honed over the course of 2,500 years that is never going to go away, shouldn't go away. I don't want to see science departments disbanded or librarians just pile up books in the middle of the floor. I mean, that's not the point. So absolutely we need, it's always domain specific, and there are places where getting 73% of what you need just won't do. If you're going to San Francisco and you're looking at photos because you want to see what it's like, and in the Flickr set, there happen to be some photos of New York, big deal. Or if you don't get all of them, big deal. But if you're a lawyer and you need to find all the case law, or you're a physicist, or you're an aircraft engineer, you really, you know, that's not good enough. So it's always domain specific, and we absolutely need to continue building those systems. But it seems to me that those systems are the exception, that when it comes to human understanding, so actually, here's the problem. I do think we have to pry the culture's hands off the notion that the only knowledge worth having is knowledge that comes through those systems, and everything else is only sort of kind of knowledge. We need to be able to say, look, that's perfectly right for that domain, but for this domain, and in fact, do not take your model, your prototype of how knowledge works, which is by definition, stipulations, experts, and perfect categories with single relationships, don't take that and say, therefore, that's how human spirit, soul, mind has to work. In fact, we don't work that way at all. We work really well without definitions. I know what a game is, and I can't define it. I know what skipping is, and I can't define it. I can't even describe skipping to you. But I certainly know what it is.
Aren't you partially dividing knowledge in a way that's kind of interesting here at Harvard, in a way between the sciences and the humanities? Subjective, objective, intuitive even, kind of, sort of, is somewhat intuitive. Does that make sense?
It does, but I wouldn't want to make that line.
Right.
It is certainly useful to be able to talk about science being more objective, by which one actually means more scientific than some elements of the humanities. Sure, yeah, absolutely. But I don't think it splits that easily, and there are big problems with maintaining the distinction between the subjective and objective, which has sort of been the story of the past 40 years of, or 50 years of philosophical thought has been the story of that this split can't be right. There's something really deeply wrong with this split. And I think some people have gotten fairly close to it. Bruno Latour, who I've only just started reading, is a philosopher who actually writes really well. I'm just flabbergasted. The guy... He writes beautifully and really clearly, and even though his material is as deep as anything, I mean, it's really good. So one of the things that he says, and I guess I'll do this as an aphorism, is that is this him? Oh damn! Well, we'll say it's him. Planes don't fly. The airline industry flies. This is exactly parallel to what I was saying before we began about knowledge not being mental. The chain of knowledge goes all the way back through the bug stuck on the pin and the label on the bug on the pin that refers back to a journal that has the entry that explains what the label means. And without that entire chain and the institution that supports it, we don't have knowledge. So, but that chain is human-made. We did it this way. There are other ways of doing it. We did it this way. It's a very good way of doing it. It was the best way of doing it at the time when we came up with this in the 19th century. But it's hard to know where you draw the line between the subject and the object, between the convention and the knowledge in this chain of knowledge that goes from...
But I see the definition in approach. Aristotelian sort of obsessiveness of getting it just right, paring away with the knife, leaving just the fact, and the more squishy, mushy, messy world of close enough, which is very creative, and again, it reinforces this divide between the sciences and the poets. I just wonder what you guys think. Am I wrong? Am I degrading the point?
No. I think a lot of scientists know at some level that a lot of this is not absolute either, right? I mean, so I don't think that, certainly there are some that are more, rigorous, but that's not the right word, rigid than others, but I think if anything, this makes
shoves it in people's face and brings the two groups closer together. Right? So that's maybe kind of a false split. Right?
One of my clients is in the middle of these problems. It's a Yellow Pages company. And traditionally, they made very good money with the top-down taxonomy stuff. And now they are wondering how they can compete in a world of this messiness. And we recently did a mapping application for them, and it was interesting to see the reaction of people.
A concept mapping or geographic mapping?
Geographical mapping. And overlaid their Yellow Pages stuff on top. And it was interesting to see how people interact with this stuff, because the first thing they obviously do is they check out the neighborhood, and there's just no way that the Yellow Pages information can outperform what they know about the neighborhood. So they're always like, oh, my local stuff is not that good. So we're wondering,
interesting,
how can we help them like increase their surface? It's like I think of them as a coral reef. Like they have this skeleton, and around that there could be lots of interesting life. So if they can become the skeleton, maybe that's something for them in the future. Now they're slowly thinking about adding user-generated content, which is such a nasty word, but
very scary for them.
So I'm wondering if the group has any. I mean, obviously, this is a big controversy also with Wikipedia and all sorts of related ventures. Whether having a pre-existing taxonomy and letting people play at the edges and add stuff and have it get fuzzier as you go further out on the tree actually helps, or whether you can just start completely from scratch and so just throw something at the wall and see whether it sticks or not.
I think this is a good example of where exactly where you want to start with something that experts have thought through, but not leave it there. So there are at least two levels of this. One is the local information, and the other is the categorization, the taxonomy that Yellow Pages uses, which are famously inadequate. Necessarily, but you know, I can't think of any of the examples. But if you want to find lumber, do you look under wood or lumber? Or, you know, plumbing. Tagging systems actually help with that. Both social tagging, or they can help, social tagging, so that if everybody's looking for, give me a good example, heating supplies, or something that's ambiguous, you have trouble finding in Yellow Pages because you don't know where to look. Car repair versus auto repair. It's under auto repair or automobiles-repair in the Yellow Pages, but everybody's thinking about car repair. Then that tag floats up to the top, and now people can find it better. Second of all, for tagging, I would love to be able to tag the items in the Yellow Pages that I use so I can find them again. You know, it's basically annotated. At the level of local information, why doesn't having users be able to add and correct what's there? This store is closed, that one just opened up.
I think that's a no-brainer. They already have to like suggest a new venue or something. But basically, when you zoom out, then the taxonomy is actually helpful, because at the country level, you don't want to see all the messiness because it's too much information. So it actually helps if you only have like five over categories. But once you zoom in, then you want maybe local news or something quirky that only exists in this location would be completely out of place if you put it all the way up in the tree.
Yeah.
So we have another sort of real world scenario that I've been thinking about. I work for a public radio exchange, and part of what we do is we take in thousands of radio pieces from public radio producers. And we have a few different ways of categorizing these. Three major categories of categories. We have the format of these pieces, which is like a commentary, documentary, short, feature, etc. Some things that make sense within the industry in some sort of general terms. We have topic area, and we have a rather limited set of topic areas designed to be pretty high-level items. And then we have something that we call tones, which is how does the piece feel? Dark, happy, sad, whatever. We defined limited lists for these three categories when we were getting started. And we said, you know what, we could just open it up, but people are going to make a mess of it, and we're just not sure that the producers are going to speak the same language that the station programmers care about, or the listeners that are just stumbling in off the site and are writing reviews and essentially tagging these things, but using our preset list of tags are going to know what the industry terms are. And so we've done that for 2 or 3 years. And we get requests to add other items, and we add some of them, and some of them we don't add. And we don't have real great criteria for deciding what we accept or not. It's sort of a gut feeling on our part. One of the things I've been thinking about recently is, well, you know, we've been doing this for 3 years. We've started to develop some conventions around what means what. People have started using a lot of these. What if we just said, all right, forget these categories of categories, forget the categories altogether. Let's just take what we've got, throw it together in a tag cloud, and let people start adding their own stuff. But the difference between, you know, the difference is we've gotten them started, and we've sort of gotten some inertia around what we think the term should be, and we're letting it grow from there. Sort of maybe a hybrid of the two ideas. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. I've just sort of been thinking about it, and I don't know if it makes sense, and I'm curious where that fits in, where something like that would fit in with your way of thinking, or if other people have thought about that sort of idea. Have we not been true to the everything is miscellaneous mantra by goosing the system?
You're not going to get the t-shirt.
Well, it kind of looks like the most successful forms of these systems are ones which have been created out of something truly messy and just very, very different. Without a frame of reference, I don't think these things can survive. So as soon as you create a few categories which are bad that sort of give people a framework for interpreting them, then they all start to whine, well, this stuff doesn't work well enough. You can then it can blur and sort of become something that's useful. In the same way that without something like Google, I think the internet would be pretty goddamn useless, because there's just no way of, if there is such a thing of being too random and to the point where it's not fuzzy, it's just brown. If it's all these different colors and you just can't work with it. So I mean, moving them out of a very hierarchical system would necessarily be a bad thing, but it certainly probably wouldn't have been able to originate of itself if it had to at the very beginning.
It's certainly possible to maintain both systems, mm-hmm. and put yours, the original one, in bigger type, and then have a section of tags. You know.
Yep.
And if it doesn't work, just drop the tags. I'm sorry, I talked over you. I'm sorry.
I have a question for you. You brought up an awful lot about there are certain systems which we ordinarily use to categorize things that are either binary or just very, very rigid. The one that came to my mind instantly was guilty or not guilty in legal context. What insights can we draw from this sort of prototypical relational system on systems which have sort of been conceived in the idea that something belongs either to column A or to column B? Like, is there any value in saying a person is 73% guilty or 47% guilty? How can you learn from that? How is it useful to these very hierarchical systems that already exist?
We do have gradations of guilt. We have mitigating circumstances, which are introduced against. We start off with guilty or not guilty, and we introduce gradations as required because they mess things up in the legal system. You know, it's cleaner if you don't have them, but you got to have them because it's only fair.
As far as I understand, mitigating circumstances are something that explains why something that would seem to obviously belong to column A doesn't in fact belong to column B. For instance, like the insanity defense. Yeah, you killed the guy, but it's not your fault. So it goes from the guilty column to the not guilty column. That doesn't seem to encompass the... It encompasses some of the spirit of
what you're
saying.
There's the, like, was this murder or was this negligent homicide gradation, where they're both characterized and guilty, but one of them is a fuzzier guilt than the other.
So,
sentencing differences and sentencing guidelines definitely would be an example of that.
But the jury is being asked to decide between two columns in a world that's not two columns. So what do you do?
Well, which is actually, I mean, that false dichotomy is where we get some problems, right?
Right.
Was OJ 49 or 51% guilty?
Yeah. It's 100% guilty.
More
than that.
Probably.
Yeah, but yeah.
yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Right. But no, I mean, but that's, I mean, so to say that there's this, it's clearly column A or it's clearly column B, even aside from sentencing guilty or not guilty, by reason of insanity, you know, I mean, it doesn't, it's not really that way. I mean, so maybe that's just a bad example. Because, I mean, I sort of see what you're getting at, but I think your point might be, well, that most of these things are not really as clear as they look on the surface, right?
Right. So,
we just try to...
Then why the drive, then, to binarize?
Well, a big bunch of, in many circumstances, we have to, because the decision we have to make requires putting a physical thing in one place or another. So libraries have to be binary about where the book goes if they only have one copy. It's got to go in one category if they're going to file, if their shelves are going to be semantic. All the sorting stuff that we do, and this is just the nature of the physical world, got to go binary on this stuff. Things like guilt, I mean, that, outside of the court system, if we did this, or somebody did something, there was an infraction in the room and we decided to handle it, we probably would not insist on a guilty or not guilty. We'd probably just try to figure out the degrees of, and, yeah, okay, I see you did it, but you didn't mean it, or, you know. For whatever reason, which I don't know, and it's a damn fine question, the legal system has decided that it has to begin with the jury coming back with a binary decision, which then gets mitigated up and down in sentencing, and so that sort of the binary nature of it is then fuzzed up a little. But for whatever I don't know, for whatever reason, juries have to make that decision. You can certainly imagine circumstances where juries wouldn't make that decision; they'd make a fuzzy one.
And that's what they do in civil cases. Say there are $100 million guilty or there are $10 million guilty, and those are pretty much combined in the same process.
Well, they chop their heads off halfway.
Yeah, some of the decisions are pretty binary.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about what you mean by knowledge? What is knowledge? I really find it very interesting.
Yes, but I think I will, and surprisingly, I'll be brief, because I think we should go. I'm trying not to be an asshole about it, which is, however, my temptation. It's very easy to caricature knowledge. Although in this case, I actually should talk about it being a prototype of knowledge. So knowledge has been the bad guy in a whole bunch of... it's a cultural theme that knowledge sucks, that knowledge diminishes, that knowledge pretends to be objective, but in fact it's a tool of oppression. And there's a lot to that analysis. So on the one hand, when I use a term, sometimes I mean it in a fairly narrow sense, where knowledge has been a system of justified true beliefs that usually are come through authorities of one kind or another. But there's a broader sense, and I think that's a fair definition. I mean, the people who have been defining knowledge have defined it that way. So But usually knowledge is more domain specific. It does have some stuff in common, but knowledge in physics is different than knowledge even in other sciences, such as evolutionary biology, you know, where knowledge has different criteria, it means different things. So it is broader than that narrow definition I just gave. But even in the clusters closest to that narrow definition, it does have some characteristics in common, and in particular, that we think of knowledge as being consistent, that it is that there's one and only one set of truths, inconsistent truths, one of them, at least one of them has to be wrong, that it's something bigger than we are, that it's transgenerational, and if you're lucky, you can apply, you can contribute to it, that it is simpler than the world, that is, the world looked at initially is complex and confusing, and knowledge finds some order and simplicity in it. Not everything is knowledge, that in a world that's so full of things to know, we have to rely upon experts, so there's a class of experts and authorities, and that it's something that is a property of the mind, that it takes a knower to have knowledge. You know, that's some set of those, I think, undergird most of what's called knowledge across the various domains. So that's more or less what I mean by it. And go! I think we're done.